In this segment, we will continue our discussion of the historical perspectives around clinical decision support. The fourth and final approach to early diagnostic expert systems was sometimes called scoring and heuristics. In this approach, knowledge would be represented as profiles of findings that occur in diseases, and we'll see an example of this in a moment. And then there would be measures of importance and frequency for each finding in each disease. This approach was certainly the most scalable of all of the early approaches to diagnostic decision support, and there were systems, some of which became commercialized, that used this approach. The Internist1/QMR system, DXplain, and ILiAD, all of which I'll briefly mention. So the original system to use this approach was Internist1, and its goal was to, in essence, develop an expert diagnostician in internal medicine. It was actually designed to mimic a particular expert diagnostician, Dr. Jack Myers from the University of Pittsburgh, who was an old-style internist who would roam the halls of the hospital and be able to go in and make diagnoses based on his fund of knowledge of findings in different diseases. Internist 1 never quite matched Jack Myers, and it evolved over time, particularly in the 1980s as PCs became more prevalent, microcomputers, and it evolved into QMR, which stood for Quick Medical Reference, where the goal was changed to, instead of being the expert diagnostician, to help a user explore the knowledge base and use that information in a clinical decision support fashion. DXplain was a system that used the principles developed in Internist 1 and QMR, but it developed a much wider spread disease coverage, and it's actually still available and people can use DXplain. And then ILiAD was a system that was developed commercially, although it really never succeeded, from the University of Utah, that used this profiles of findings in diseases approach, but instead of the simple formulas that Internist 1 QMR used, which I'll show in a moment, it attempted to actually use Bayesian statistics in the diagnostic process. So how did the Internist 1 QMR approach represent knowledge? Well, again, we had disease profiles, so these were findings known to reliably occur in the disease. And then we had the findings themselves. They might be something from the medical history, such as the patient complaining of chest pain with certain characteristics. They might be something detected on the exam, such as a heart murmur, or from the laboratory, so a blood test result like a low hemoglobin or an abnormality on a chest x-ray. Now, each finding in the knowledge base, regardless of the disease, also had a measure of import, how important it was to explain. Some findings are important in diseases, but are actually nonspecific, like fever. So fever has a lower import to explain than, say, chest pain, which occurs in many fewer diseases. Findings also have properties that help the database run more efficiently. And some of these are, for example, like taboos. So the system would not allow a male to have pregnancy as a finding. Likewise, a female would not have findings that would lead to prostate cancer, such as a prostate nodule detected on a physical exam. So for each of these findings in a disease, there would be two measures, evoking strength and frequency. Evoking strength is the likelihood of a disease given a finding, whereas frequency is the likelihood of a finding given a disease. So how do you keep these two straight? Well, again, evoking strength is what is how much a finding evokes a disease, how specific that finding is to a disease. So the finding might be completely nonspecific to that disease because it occurs in many diseases, or it might be pathognomonic, which in essence means when the finding is present, the disease is present. And so it was scored on a 0 to 5 scale. The frequency, on the other hand, is just a measure of how often the finding occurs in a disease. The finding may occur frequently, so have a high frequency, but be nonspecific, so have a low evoking strength. And frequency is scored on a 1 to 5 scale. So here is a disease profile for acute myocardial infarction. This actually is a screenshot from the QMR application displaying the findings in acute myocardial infarction. There's 134, and they can be displayed in textbook order, so history, symptoms, signs, and labs, or by frequency. Here they're shown in textbook order, and I've expanded the symptoms of current illness. So as you can see, some findings like chest pain substernal at rest, chest pain substernal lasting 20 minutes or more, has a pretty high frequency, but actually the evoking strength is a little bit lower because these findings are not necessarily specific to myocardial infarction. So how does the scoring actually work? Well, what happens is the user enters the initial positive and negative findings, and it's important to enter the negative findings, the things that are not present. And this then creates a disease hypothesis for any disease that has one or more of the of its positive findings entered. And each disease hypothesis gets a score. There's a positive component that's based on the evoking strengths of all findings, so what's evoking the disease. There's a negative component based on the frequency from findings that are expected to occur but have been designated as not occurring. And then each disease has a score, and a diagnosis is made when the top-ranking diagnosis is 80 points, which is what the algorithm uses, or in essence one pathognomonic finding above the next highest diagnosis. And when a diagnosis is made and the user states it has been, all the findings for that disease are removed, and then subsequent diagnoses are made. The 1982 paper from the New England Journal of Medicine by Randy Miller describes this algorithm in detail, as does the chapter in the short-lived textbook. So how did internist one do relative to physicians? Well, like the other systems, it outperformed them. Some of you are familiar with the clinical cases in the New England Journal of Medicine where a physician presents the case and then some expert gives the diagnosis, and then they always ask the medical students, and the medical students always get it right, even more so than the expert. So they looked at how internist one performed, and internist one actually performed as well as the experts and better than the physician taking care of the patient for a series of cases from New England Journal of Medicine. So why too, do you ask, was the internist one and then QMR system not more widely used? Well, it had some limitations. It had a long learning curve, so it took a lot to learn how to use both internist one and QMR. Data entry in the 1970s, 1980s was very time consuming. No point and click mouse, everything had to be typed in. Another key issue with any type of diagnostic expert system is that diagnostic dilemmas are not really a major proportion of clinician information needs. That is, a true diagnostic dilemma where you have all these symptoms and you don't really know what the diagnosis is not that common of a situation. It's much more common to be stumped by the results of a single test, single diagnostic test. And of course, another challenge of Internist 1 and QMR is that the knowledge base was incomplete. So Internist 1 did evolve to QMR after it was found that there really was less value in the case mode and more value in exploring the knowledge base. So allowing the user to rule in and rule out diseases based on findings that were present or absent, to obtain differential diagnoses for a group of findings, and also to link to more detailed information on a diagnosis. Well, QMR became a commercial product, but it really didn't succeed in the marketplace, and it's now no longer marketed. So, as I have said in these last two segments, a great deal of work took place in the 1960s, 70s, 80s in diagnostic decision support. It was really believed that that was where medical informatics was going to have its big impact. Interestingly enough, I entered the field, did my initial training in the late 1980s, and at this time it was becoming apparent that, first of all, the diagnostic process was too complex for computer programs. All of the systems took way too long in terms of time of use and really didn't provide the information that clinicians truly needed. And in essence, this kind of Greek oracle model, as Randy Miller, one of the original developers of Internist 1, called it, the Greek oracle model of just giving the diagnosis down to the physician, was really not that medically useful. But we learned a lot, and we've learned some other things recently. For example, diagnostic decision support systems are less effective than therapeutic systems. There was a general acknowledgement of a general failure of all the hype, not only in medicine, but other areas in the 1980s about expert systems and artificial intelligence to live up to its expectations. However, we do need to keep in mind that diagnostic error still continues and does do harm to patients. So even though the systems that were developed in the earlier era did not contribute useful solutions, we still have a problem to solve. So where are we headed now? Well, as I said at the beginning of this part, decision support evolved in the 1990s in tandem with the growing use of electronic health records and the recognition of how they could be best used within the electronic health record. And so rules and algorithms were actually found to be quite useful. And we'll see later in this unit that they are used in modern systems, although not in the kind of diagnostic decision support way. And again, there was this evolution from kind of broad-based diagnostic decision support to more narrow therapeutic decision support. A number of leaders in the field, along with AMIA, published a roadmap for decision support in general recently, and the key pillars of decision support they advocate are having the best knowledge available to the physician when needed, making sure that there is high adoption and effective use, and continually improving the knowledge and the methods. This all said, there actually is some continued effort in diagnostic decision support. There's a system called Isabel. It's the company that markets it calls it a second generation approach. And some of its key features are that it uses natural language processing to take text that is entered and map those into findings, so the user doesn't have to go through this long menu-driven entry process. And instead of trying to rank the diagnoses by probability, a list of the most likely differential diagnosis is given and grouped by body system. So the system's not really attempting to make the diagnosis as much as it is to strongly encourage the user to think about what's at the top of its list. So how does Isabel do? Well, there have been some studies. It was initially developed and validated for pediatrics. And in a clinical setting, it reminded users of one clinically important diagnosis 1 out of 8 times, so in 1 out of 8 cases. It was subsequently extended and evaluated in the emergency department and was found to display the correct diagnosis in its list of 30, 95% of the time, and 90% of the time showed a diagnosis that a clinician expert felt was one that the system must not miss. So now the system has been expanded to adult internal medicine, and kind of characteristic of the modern era, but using the long-standing New England Journal of Medicine case reports, which are now pasted into the system, copied and pasted, so they don't need to be typed anymore. And when the key text from the case was copied and pasted into Isabel, 48 out of 50 times the correct diagnosis was displayed in that 30. And when the entire text of the article was pasted in, which introduces a lot more noise, still 37 out of the 50 correct diagnoses showed up in these cases. So one final approach that is somewhat tongue-in-cheek is Googling for a diagnosis. However, Google, with its billions of web pages, may actually hold latent knowledge in there that can be used to make a diagnosis. And this came to light when a group of specialists were stumped on a case and someone went and typed the findings into Google, and sure enough, the correct diagnosis of a rare condition popped up, which turned out to be what the patient had. So then someone had to do the usual entering the New England Journal of Medicine clinical cases into the system and see what happens. So a study entered 26 cases from the New England Journal of Medicine in, and 15 of them had the correct diagnosis suggested in the top 3 diagnoses that could be gleaned from the Google output.